Public Affairs, June 25th, 1999,
1:30 p.m.
Chair, Senator
Durkin,
Chair.
We've got Senate Bill 1231, and the first person that is going to describe what the bill is Senator Hammond. Senator, you want to come up and tell us what the bill is and why we need to pass it?
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Len Hannon, State Senator, District 26. Mr. Chair, I'd like to start off by thanking you for working to develop a consensus and a compromise on this bill. This is a bill that's been introduced from the beginning of the session, and I know it's taken a great deal of movement on your part to negotiate a reasonable settlement, and I want to commend you for that.
I appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, members, what this bill does, it basically does two things. The first thing is, not since 1987, when mental health coverage was instituted in the state of Oregon, has the benefit level been increased to the consumer or that client who's covered under an insurance policy? The first thing the bill does is it increases the benefit level by 25%. The net effect then to the consumer or the business person or whoever, premium dollar wise, is approximately a 1 to 1.5% increase, which would translate into about $3. You had the numbers that your staff prepared for you, and I don't have those in front of me. But that's the first thing the bill does. The second thing the bill does is it creates an interim task force on mental health parity, and it sets forth criteria to look at. And what we're supposed to do is spend our time during the interim looking at both issues, both sides, and see if the money is just going to additional providers without generating a level increase of services to the public. That should be the bottom line. That's who we serve. You and I both share that same commitment. And we are supposed to report back as a task force to the next session on potential legislation, either to expand it, to change it, to modify it, to do whatever, but it'll be based upon factual and document information, not he said, she said, or anything else, but it'll be prepared by actuaries doing the documentation and verifying the figures of what the cost impact is. Those are the only two things that the bill does. There's a set of amendments, Mr. Chairman, that you have agreed to present before the committee. And beyond that, it's a bill that's attempting to help people. And I know you and I have had a private conversation on this, and you and I both share the same commitment. We're not interested in furthering ourselves, but if we're able to help one person, it will be well worth the work that we put in on the bill. For that reason, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank you and the members of the committee for allowing me to be here.
Well, Senator, I'd like to thank you for being able to sit down and talk about this and work out an agreement that I think is someplace in the middle, and I hope it serves both sides well. So thank you. I look forward to the next session to come back and learn more about it to see what we can do to make it work better.
I'll try not to be as stubborn.
I don't think either one of them would like to change.
I don't either.
Any questions for Senator? Again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
What we're going to do today, because I think we have sort of reached an agreement of what we're going to do, we are going to try to give each side a half hour to express their side, and most of us have other meetings to go to after that. So we're going to start out with the opponents, and we have three signed up. We have Kevin Earls, Joe Gillian, and Steve Doty. If they're going to come forward and tell us why we shouldn't do this, and We have a few people signed up that want to talk about it, so if we could have those three people come up first, we'd appreciate it. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kevin Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries, and with me today is Steve Doty from Northwest Employee Benefits. And I think we're going to be joined in a minute by Mr. Gillian from NFIB. I have some prepared testimony, which I'd offer for the record, and I'll summarize our concerns about the bill. Briefly. First of all, a bit about Associated Oregon Industries. AOI is Oregon's largest business organization. We represent 19,000 Oregon businesses and their employees, and our members employ 30% of Oregon's entire private workforce. Most of our member employers provide health insurance, employer-sponsored coverage, as part of the benefit package that they provide to their workers. And in most cases, their workers' families. So our perspective on issues related to health care and health care costs are related primarily from the perspective of a purchaser. We think that unilaterally increasing mental health benefits is a bad idea. And I'll just outline briefly for you why we feel that way. First, we think Oregon has worked to expand coverage for all Oregonians, and AOI has been a part of those efforts with many of the people in this room, and in fact, many of the people that are on the other side of this issue. But at the outset, we've recognized that we have finite resources to spend on health care, both as a state, as employer purchasers, and as individuals that have to contribute to their own health care costs. So recognizing those limitations, we've collectively decided to keep benefits modest in order to reach more people. And we've done that by resisting enacting new mandates and repealing existing mandates on occasion. We've kept costs low to encourage employers to add employment-based coverage, and we've carefully examined any proposed mandate or increase to see if it will raise costs and what benefit it will provide the people that have coverage. The results of that careful collaboration, I think, are evident. The uninsured rate in Oregon has plummeted from 18% to 11%. Employer-sponsored coverage in this state in the past 5 years has increased dramatically from 55% to 70%. That's the percent of Oregonians that are receiving their coverage through employer-sponsored coverage. Nationally, during the same time period, the results have been the reverse. Uninsured rates have increased, and employer-sponsored coverage has declined. We think that Oregon's existing mental health and drug and alcohol and chemical dependency benefit is working well. It provides coverage to everyone that has group coverage in the state. It allows employer flexibility to purchase additional benefits that reflect a group's preference and their ability to afford richer benefits. And we believe that there is no clearly identified need or evidence that the current limited benefit, and it is a limited benefit, is not working. And so in the absence of some compelling evidence, we think the legislature should resist voluntarily increasing the cost of coverage. Because increased benefits mean increased costs, and that's not just for the employer. It's going to reflect in increased costs for employees and the families that are covered through employer-sponsored coverage. Increased costs threaten existing coverage for people that have coverage today, coverage that already provides mental health benefits. It also, I think, has a dampening effect on groups that don't have coverage today where an employer would like to add coverage and they recognize that now the legislature is stepping in and voluntarily increasing benefits, things that are out of the purchaser's control. And so I think that has a dampening effect. So in conclusion, some who have coverage today will be without coverage in the future. We think there are questions that you ought to consider of the proponents, asking the proponents before you enact the bill or take action on the bill. First of all, how many Oregonians are actually bumping it up against the policy limits that are in statute today? And we need to know clearly, in order to take the best action, where is our current statutory benefit not working, so that we can design, I think, a more targeted approach to fixing that, rather than unilaterally enacting a 25% increase in benefits. Secondly, what is the total cost of the proposed increase in millions of dollars? I mean, we know it will be tens of millions of dollars for this increase, and I think you'll hear testimony about that impact. So I think we need to look at the total cost of that. Third, how does Oregon's benefit package in law compare to national benefits, national averages? Are we ahead of the curve? Are we in the middle, perhaps, where we ought to be, remembering that we're trying to keep benefits modest in order to reach more people? But we need a context. So I think those are questions that I would encourage this committee and your legislative colleagues to consider in the context of this bill. And with that, I appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony.
Well, we appreciate your being here to testify.
Thank you.
Sir? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Doty. I'm an agent specializing in the sale of group health insurance. I've been in the business for about 23 years. I also am the legislative chair for the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters, which is an organization of agents in similar business as myself. I also serve as chair of the Health Insurance Reform Advisory Committee for the state and serve on the Insurance Governing Board. I'm here today to talk about some concerns that I have about this kind of a mandate and the cost impact it would have on the consumers that I represent, who are the employers. I know there's a lot of discussion about how this bill is good for consumers, but there's a segment of the consumer population that hasn't been heard from much, and that is the consumer who pays for all of this, and those are my clients, and I'm here to speak on their behalf. 4 years ago, we passed in 1995 some significant market reform legislation that eliminated many of the underwriting barriers that prohibited individuals and groups from acquiring adequate health insurance. As a result of that legislation, we've seen the kind of numbers that Kevin alluded to, a reduction in the uninsured population and more employers are offering more group insurance for their employees than ever before. But today we face a more difficult problem, and that is the problem of cost. We are seeing an average of about 20% increase in premiums just this year, some as high as 80%. As we deliver those renewals to our clients, they are faced with some very difficult decisions. Because as these premiums become unaffordable, they are left with very few choices. One, they can reduce the benefits, they can pass the increased premium on to their employees, or they can simply drop the coverage.
In the cases where you're seeing 80% increases, what do you attribute those increases to?
Just the claim utilization. That particular case.
Sorry, just what?
The claims utilization. That's that particular case.
They're using their insurance.
Yeah. But as they cost more, there becomes a point where employers have to make the decision whether they can afford to continue that coverage.
If you give them more to use, it's likely to increase the cost.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is the concern I have, is a trend for government to micromanage health insurance plans and instead of letting those decisions be made in the marketplace by employers.
Okay, if the marketplace got to do it and you wanted to reduce those 80% increases, how would you do it?
80%.
Well, you said 20 to 80%.
Okay.
Well, 20%, I guess we're accustomed to, that's not terribly unusual, but 80% is pretty high. So how would you reduce those 80%?
Employers would be allowed to design the plans as they see fit, as they're paying for it.
So they will be able to eliminate certain categories of coverage. Is that most likely to get you where to reduce it?
That's a possibility. There are several options that they can look at to try to reduce their premiums. But as we, when you look at health plans now, there's unlimited, essentially unlimited costs, unlimited benefit for hospital stays and doctor stays and prescription drug benefits. And yet those benefits are not there because they're mandated. They're there because the market has demanded them. But employers, people are paying for those benefits, want those kind of benefits. And in my 22 years of experience in selling health insurance plans to employers, I have never had an employer come to me and complain that the chemical dependency and the mental health benefit is not adequate. There's never been an issue. But what they are complaining about to me today is the cost. And as I come in with significant rate increases, employers are facing difficult decisions about whether or not to even continue this kind of coverage. I'll give you an example that happened just this week. A small employer client of mine with 4 employees has a 23% increase in their premiums. We shopped the coverage to see if we get a better buy. We weren't able to find anything much better. The employer called me Wednesday and said his decision is to drop the coverage. He's going to buy individual coverage for himself. His employers are on their own. And there's only one reason that happened, and that's cost. And anything we do that's going to continue to add to the cost of insurance, I think will add more people to the uninsured role in this space. And I think that's a mistake. And I think we need to be very careful as we move down this path of continuing to require insurance plans to cover more and more benefits that are going to add to the premium. And that's the main point that I would like to make today. As I meet with my employers, they're very concerned about the cost. And I'm concerned about this trend that we see of mandating more and more benefits and the impact that will have upon cost. I have some prepared written testimony that I'm happy to leave with the committee. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Do you have questions for these two since we're staying together? Appreciate you taking your time to come down. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Gilliam, representing the National Federation of Independent Business, over 14,000 small businesses here in the state of Oregon. Two-thirds of our membership have 10 employees or less, to give you an idea of the size of businesses we represent. I came here today to share with you, we are concerned not so much, we don't really have an argument with the benefit we're talking about, the type of benefit that we're talking about, but the cost issue, and that this particular bill does have a cost impact on premiums. And to share with you just some of the statistics that we put together, told our members in January of this year, and why the cost issue is a very sensitive issue to the small business community, and it does really impact the availability of coverage in total versus just the coverage for mental health, drug and alcohol. In 1995, we reached our highest level, our highest percentage of our membership that was providing employer-provided health care benefits, largely due to a lot of the things that the legislature did in 91 and 93 dealing with the market. Guaranteed issue coverage, guaranteed renewability, rate bans, things like that allowed the small business owner to get into the market. But prior to that, they weren't a very attractive account. We kind of struggled being real attractive to big, large companies because we have 5 lives or 6 lives and, you know, the administrative costs associated with that. But these other laws have helped us. And so we got as high as 73% of our membership covering their employees, which is a very good number for the small business community. Unfortunately, as of this year, we've slid to 59%. And that's quite a slide. We also asked them what happened to their premiums during this period. And 47% of our membership who provide the health care experienced a rate increase in excess of 11%. 1 year just hit them. Now, 16% of that was over 20%. 16% of the total was over 20% increase. And so what we're seeing is the costs go up, they're letting the coverage go, just as Mr. Doty said. They're making a decision. What's our alternative? And they really have two alternatives when the decision's made. And that is, one, increase the employees' share of the cost to keep their price the same. That means higher deductibles, higher co-pays, less coverage, those types of things, in order to shift the cost to the employee so the coverage remains in place, or just to eliminate it altogether. And when we get to the elimination of the coverage, we reach a point where we're going backwards from what we tried to do since 1989 and getting more people, more incentives to cover health care, and we're in that trend now. And it's unfortunate, but we're very concerned about bills like this that will increase the cost of the basic premium, because my folks really don't provide, you know, unfortunately they can't afford to buy the big kind of Cadillac plans. They're providing basic plans with basic mandates in them, and this will have a fiscal impact that's going to make our numbers go the wrong way here. We'll slide from the 59% covering, and we will start seeing that the premium rise, and those are just, when those start working against each other, we got a real problem.
Questions? I guess, further, you've all talked about increased costs. What kind of costs are we talking about here? Do you know what we're likely to be seeing?
There are some people coming up.
Okay, all right.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Duke, if I could just respond, not to talk specifically about costs. I think from our perspective, it's very easy to lose sight when you talk about a 1% or 2% cost. But to look at it in terms of the millions of dollars that it represents in an aggregate form for the state, and how that really moves in a completely different direction than our philosophy has been over the past 10 years, which is to resist mandating increased costs in order to provide people access to basic coverage, and then when they have more money and a greater desire to buy up from that coverage. And that's the environment that we're asking you to protect and maintain, because it's worked very well in Oregon at a time when the uninsured rate in the rest of the country is increasing.
Yes, I would have a question. I don't see the answer. Perhaps next week could. What percentage of the people is this going to serve, this increase? Do you know how many people, like we have people on the list of rules, like this one will affect, we have people that are self-insured, what effect we have, people buy their own insurance, there are people uninsured, they're not going to get any of the benefits from this.
Well, Senator Durkler, I'll answer your question in two ways, if I might. First of all, I think it won't affect ERISA plans, self-insured plans.
Which is what? 25% of the population?
You know, I don't have those numbers available. I know it's a pretty substantial portion of, even in our state where it's predominantly a small business state, it's still a large portion. And I believe it won't affect individual plans. But let me answer it a different way. I don't think it's going to affect most people that have coverage today, because from their perspective, they have more than enough mental health benefits. This is not going to come into play for them. All it's going to do is increase costs. So for most Oregonians who have health insurance coverage today, whether it's through a individual plan, a self-insured plan, or a group plan, this is not going to help them. It's going to increase their costs.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the only thing, can I add one thing?
Sure.
One of the good things we did, the good things we've done with the Oregon Health Plan, and covering so many other people and bringing our uninsured rate down and cost shifting plays against us a little bit, because it's created kind of a mental safety net out there that, well, if I have to cancel my coverage as a five-person business, they can always go to the Oregon Health Plan. And as a broader policy, I mean, it's nice to have the safety net, but as a broader policy where we want to move people, you have to keep the business community, the incentives there and the affordability, because if you cost shift it on to the state, that budget's rising at an enormous rate already. It just puts more pressure on your general fund dollars to keep up with it. So the more we can do to keep people in the private system, the better off we are as a state as a whole. And cost pressure moves us in the opposite direction. That's
Mr. Chair,
a hard problem.
Generally works if your employers are paying right around poverty level wages.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, it's a matter of a small business, particularly young businesses starting out, have the starting wage, have many workers that are coming in who have no skills or entry-level skills.
But don't you guys have a lot of small businesses out there that are paying?
Well, absolutely, Senator. We would like to, more of them want to, and we want to do whatever we can to help that. We're just saying that as there's a cost pressure, whether it's this mandate or another one, we're not arguing the mental health issue. You only give them so many choices because they don't have any other, they can't take an exemption to pay their taxes because they're providing health care. They have to do all that first and unfortunately provide the benefits last in the way our system's set up.
Thank you.
Thank you all three for coming up. Okay. Are you going to be on the pro or the con here? So I know the timing. We're still limiting the time on each side here. So. Okay. So we'll take that off of that side. Come on up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Abel Gordley, State Senator from District 10, which covers portions of Northeast and Southeast Portland. I am very pleased today to be able to testify in support of Senate Bill 1331. First, I would like to applaud the good senator from Ashland for his leadership and perseverance, and to pledge my support to follow this effort to fruition. Despite Senator Hannon's leadership and that of former State Representative Margaret Carter heading the interim task force on mental health integration, this state has failed to provide adequate mental health services to Oregonians in need. The most recent report on mental health services for this state sits idle, not even a part of the legislative or budgetary discussion this session. We must prioritize mental health services. Senate Bill 1331 is an honest and doable beginning in that direction. I would add that the bipartisan legislative efforts of the Social Support Strategy Initiative also seeks to address mental health service delivery and the associated needs from physical medical services to affordable housing. As the last legislative session of this century, we need to demonstrate, Mr. Chair, the leadership and will to embark on a constructive, healthful approach to enhancing the quality of life for all Oregonians. And that includes the adequate provision of mental health services in our state. Thank you very much.
Appreciate you coming down to us. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have John Paul, Matthew, and Peggy, Annette. If you want to come up and
Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. You're going to be handed a written testimony, Mr. Chairman, and I'll try to abbreviate it, and I would simply ask that you deduct the time that Senator Duke's questions will take from our side. We understand that the time pressures you're under and the timing of the session and your need to take action today. And some of our comments will go beyond what you're going to do today. Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon has historically opposed mandates in the Oregon legislature on the private sector. We're concerned about those costs and how they affect the employer community and their purchasing habits. We are further concerned that the proposal that includes a 25% increase in these minimum benefits does not include sections that would strengthen the carrier's ability to manage this health care and to make sure that the providers are providers of quality services to the people that we insure. And first, the cost. Regents Actuarial and Underwriting Department has determined that a 25% increase in the statutory minimum limit for mental health and chemical dependency coverage will result in a 1% yearly increase for employers covered under HMO Oregon and a 1.56% increase yearly for employers covered under Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon preferred provider and traditional products. The annual cost impact to the employers covered under Regents HMO Oregon and Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon products is estimated to be a combined amount of $14.9 million per year. On the management side, Senate Bill 529 actually included in it a provision for management of the benefits by insurers. That is printed on the second page of the testimony that I've handed you, and that is from Senate Bill 529, and it states that, and I quote, "Nothing in this bill prohibits a group health insurer from managing the provision of benefits through common methods, including but not limited to the pre-admission screening, prior authorization of services, utilization review, or other mechanisms designed to limit eligible services to those defined in this section." We think that ultimately in this process that language like that should be added to Senate Bill 1331, and we will work with the proponents of the original bill as well on this issue. Additionally, the issue of quality of provision of services is important.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. You're going to be handed a written testimony, Mr. Chairman, and I'll try to abbreviate it. And I would simply ask that you deduct the time that Senator Duke's questions will take from our time. We understand that the time pressures you're under and the timing of the session and your need to take action today. And some of our comments will go beyond what you're going to do today. Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon has historically opposed mandates in the Oregon legislature on the private sector.
We're concerned about those costs and how they affect the employer community and their purchasing habits. We are further concerned that the proposal that includes a 25% increase in these minimum benefits does not include sections that would strengthen the carrier's ability to manage with health care and to make sure that the providers are providers of quality services to the people that we insure. And first, the cost. Regents Actuarial and Underwriting Department has determined that a 25% increase in the statutory minimum limits for mental health and chemical dependency coverage will result in a 1% yearly increase for employers covered under HMO Oregon and a 1.56% increase yearly for employers covered under Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon preferred provider and traditional products. The annual cost impact to the employers covered under Regents HMO Oregon and Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon products is estimated to be a combined amount of $14.9 million per year. On the management side, Senate Bill 529 actually included in it a provision for management of the benefits by insurers. That is printed on the second page of the testimony that I've handed you, and that is from Senate Bill 529, and it states that, and I quote, "Nothing in this bill prohibits a group health insurer from managing the provision of benefits through common methods, including but not limited to the pre-admission screening, prior authorization of services, utilization review, or other mechanisms designed to limit eligible services to those defined in this section." We think that ultimately in this process, that language like that should be added to Senate Bill 1331, and we will work with the proponents of the original bill as well on this issue. Additionally, the issue of quality provision of services is important. You know, health insurers have come under a lot of scrutiny, and as a result of that, they have assisted in the development of medical standards for the delivering of services, and they undergo credentialing by national organizations to assure that the services that they're providing and pay for are of a high quality. Currently, under Oregon law, there are programs provided in the mental health area through counties and designated by counties that health insurers must reimburse. And we think that's an issue that also needs to be looked at, because we cannot demand the same quality standards of those programs and the provision of that care to those programs as we can through other contracted programs. So we wanted to bring that issue to the committee as well and pledge our efforts to work to the improvement of the delivery of mental health services, as well as any increase in benefits the legislature might approve.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America, and I will be brief and not repeat any of the comments that I've heard thus far. The first thing I'd like to say is HRA is concerned about an across-the-board 25% adjustment without a particular analysis or focus on the need for adjustments in targeted areas. The cost issue, of course, is significant, and I would like to remind the committee members that under the Federal Mental Health Parity Act, any increase in excess of 1% would then warrant an exemption from the federal parity requirements. The specific thing that I wanted to draw to your attention, if costs are increased as a result of parity under the Federal Parity Act, if your costs go up by 1%, then you are no longer subject. You can be exempt from having to implement the parity requirements in the plan.
Thank you. tell me what that means.
That means if your costs go up, if your mental health costs go up and given there by 1%, then you no longer have to provide therapy under the terms and conditions of the federal law. What I wanted to call your attention was I did some research and I realized we found some data from the National Association of Psychiatric Health Systems, which is an association comprised of entities that provide psychiatric mental health benefits. And under Oregon's current law, when you translate the current dollar amounts into lengths of stays in facilities and day visits, you will find that presently Oregon already provides higher benefits than are consistent with what the national trends are. For example, in terms of inpatient days, the inpatient stay in Oregon equates roughly to 14 days, and on a national level, that's at 11.5 days. The one that is most notable is when you get to outpatient visits. Oregon currently provides for 29 visits. The national trend is 8.7 visits for outpatients. In terms of residential days, the Oregon provides 19 days, and on a national basis, that average is 13. And I would only like to also comment along the lines of what Senator Gordon said, and that is mental health is an area that is extremely complicated and extremely controversial. What happens in this discussion is we focus on the employer-provided portion of mental health benefits at the expense of a whole host of other issues that are out there. And so for that reason, we're very supportive of the study and really believe that a review of the overall system is much warranted, and that way we can make better determinations as to what are appropriate benefit levels and employer-provided coverages and what are the other services that really need to be reviewed and addressed that also help people that have severe mental illness problems.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dooley, ODS Health Plans. First of all, I want to thank you, Senator, for taking the time to work and try and find common ground on a very difficult issue. And then you've taken a lot of hours, and we want to thank you for those efforts. We're not excited about Senate Bill 1331 in the sense of what NFIB talked about, and AOI, we think the marketplace should dictate the choices that the employers and the employees make in the health insurance marketplace. Unfortunately, we are seeing some substantial increases. Mr. Gilliam alluded to those. And if you take a family that is covered for $400 a month and you receive a 20% increase, or a firm is above that, for example, that's an additional $80 per month. And when you throw in additional increases that we've talked about, albeit not significant, they will affect the marketplace, and that does concern us. So on the one hand, we provide some additional coverages. On the other hand, people are not going to be insured as well as they were before. I know those are trade-offs, but we would support OI and NFIB to have as many people as insured as possible. We would echo our support for the amendments and the conversation Mr. Powell had regarding the quality of service provisions. We think they should be looked at, not only in the room, but at least on the House side, perhaps. We know you have a difficult task and a time frame here to move the bill. So I did want to echo our support for those provisions or attempts for additional amendments. Thank you for your attention.
John, you gave us the numbers, 1% for one class of insurance, and 1.56% for the other. Those based on an actuarial study?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's based on the actuarial estimate of our underwriting and actuarial department. Viewing the use of past experience and claims data and that sort of thing.
Is that something we can look at and we can review? Because I know that on the numbers they seem to be two sides, and both have numbers, and I don't know how to make that kind of decision, because obviously the numbers show a serious issue here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we would be glad to get an actuary to work with you and the legislature to work on those numbers. I think, however, that the numbers have not been as far off as maybe some of the reports about the numbers. Our numbers in looking at the issues before the legislature have been what I think is a reasonable range of numbers provided by the other side. I think what got things askew in terms of the numbers game is that there were attempts by some to suggest how much of the increase would be paid for by employers and how much would be paid for by the employees. And so when those numbers were broke down into two categories, it raised a lot of issues about the numbers. But the numbers about the total cost, I don't think are far off in terms of the percentage of premium that would be needed, premium increase that would be needed to fund these programs.
Okay, the numbers are sort of overall increase in cost have been significantly different.
I think when we looked at the study that was given, I think we had a study on that, they were talking about the dollar 27 cents a month. But when we really looked at it, there was a 3% increase for what they were trying to cover, which would, the average policy would probably be $12 to $15 per month.
And those were things, I mean, is that
doable? They broke it down by per person, $5.27 per person, mm-hmm. assuming the employer was paying like 30% of the cost of insurance. If you really read the report, basically for the rates, based on a 30% increase, it would be about a 3% increase of benefits. And you consider the average policy is about $450. And the 2% was probably at a base. They said computer 5.6%. So the rule
is... And that particular coverage, in mental health coverage? Okay.
That was the issue right in that perspective. If you would have got into looking at the figures, the issue would be much, much different.
But I guess, can we get what your actuarial estimates were? Is that something you can really...
Chairman Sanders, I'm sure we can get you some, and we might even attach a live actuary to it.
Not required, but okay.
Okay, thank you
very much. Thank you for
your time. Okay, now we've got Dr. Connie Pryor, Scott McGowan, and Mark Nelson. I did have 45 minutes to go down until 3 o'clock on this foundation.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm the designated starter. My name is John Dillon. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. And fortunately for you and the rest of the committee, I brought my SIM file. There are other volumes in my office. But first of all, let me say that I really do, the Medical Association and Coalition, really appreciate the efforts you've made to walk through this controversial issue, to reach a proposal with Senator Hannon that can move forward from this committee. We, of course, are supporting the Advantage to Amendments, and again, appreciate your assistance in that as well. I've given you written comments, so I'll try to summarize, and I would like to maybe respond to one or two comments from previous testimony, and then I'll turn it over to, I guess, Mr. Nelson, and then Dr. Powell, who is with us as well, would like to make some brief comments, too. One of the issues that was raised, and you'll find this on page 2 of my testimony, was whether or not there was a defined problem that the Medical Association Coalition was trying to address. And we have argued that, in fact, there is one. It happens to be a population base or insured base of patients of about 7% who appear from the data that we have to be bumping up to the current limits of fraud and statutes for benefits that we believe they need for additional treatment. And that would be for both outpatient services to some degree, inpatient hospital services as well. So there is, in fact, some definable data based off of not only our own surveys of practicing Oregon physicians, but it's very consistent with in the sense of whether people are getting adequate coverage for psychiatric and mental health and emotional alcohol and drug problems or not. So that issue is fairly, I think, fairly consistent. I believe that the other point I really want to make, too, is that Senate Bill 1331 will, in fact, provide us the opportunity to go into excruciating detail, either about numbers, about policies that the state might want to consider, what kind of impact may have on small employers and others who provide coverage, health coverage, in the state of Oregon. We, too, as a medical association with over 6,000 members, are very sensitive to health insurance premium costs, since we also employ thousands of individuals as well. And so we have tried to be very sensitive to that issue. I believe that all of you are well aware, we, the Medical Association Coalition, distributed a February poll, statewide poll, which I think in part has some relevance to some of the discussion today as well, because one of the questions that we raised was whether or not the individuals who were polled whether they had or anyone in their family had obtained treatment for mental health, alcohol, or drug problems in the last 5 years. 23% of those responded that they had. We followed that question as well with whether their insurance company covered those costs. And 54% responded that some of the costs or none of the costs were covered. So again, we believe that there is in fact some anomaly or problem between the clinical need for appropriate services and a benefit level that has not changed over about 12.
So I mean, that 54%. They didn't have coverage.
We did inquire of those who had insurance coverage. So these are individuals who had.
How many of those were under the risk rules that didn't apply? How many were self-insured?
Mr. Chairman, the federal ERISA rules in regard to mental health coverage that was adopted by Congress, I believe, a couple of years ago, essentially said that for those ERISA employers who currently provide benefits for mental health services, that they would continue, that they would be required to continue that coverage. If those costs bump up to 1%, they could choose to not provide that coverage under the health benefit plan. And we had you and I, in a, I think in another meeting, had a discussion about this. So I recall four companies nationally had filed, four or five had filed under the provision to withdraw mental health coverage under that law. Three of them, in fact, were in Oregon. Now, one was two of them were from Ashland, automobile company. I've forgotten who the third company was, but out of all the companies in the country that have 50 or more employees, four companies, at least as of about 6 months ago, have chosen to opt out. So I don't think it's been shown, at least under that provision, to be a particularly problematic issue at this stage. The association and coalition also, Mr. Chairman, as you'll recall, provided you with an actuarial estimate of what a 40% benefit increase would in our actuarial firm's estimate cost in premiums, which I'm trying to find from PricewaterhouseCoopers, and as we all recognize, this is a 25%, and this proposes a 25% benefit increase. Under our actuarial estimate for a 30% increase, the gross market impact was estimated at 1%, and it did vary depending on the particular type of plan. From a low of 1% for PPOs or family service plans to 1.9 for fee for service for a gross for an average of 1% and potentially a net of much less than that. So it is our belief that the bill before you today will in fact be substantially less than 1 to 1.5% premium increase in this process. I'd like to briefly comment about the suggestions from, I believe, Regents Blue Cross about some additional amendments. In the Senate Bill 529, the original Senate Bill 529, there was some language as included in their testimony. There was also additional language about medical necessity that we believe in combination would have to be considered, and we'll most certainly be happy to talk to the proponents of this to see if we can come to some agreement of whether or not additional language is needed. But Senate Bill 1331 does not make any modifications to the current statute as it operates today with the addition of the past two amendments. And so it should be a mechanism which insurers are quite well accustomed to operate under. With that, I'll close my comments.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Oregon Society of Clinical Social Workers. I want to take a few steps back from the bill that you're looking at today, and because I don't want to lose sight of the original concept, which was mental health parity. As the chairman, I think, is painfully aware, this has been a very contentious discussion within the body, within the legislature. But I think it's more than just a discussion of cost, and Scott has struck on those, and I'll say a few words as well. But it's really speaking to a philosophy that says that we are not going to treat in our health insurance policies mental health any differently than we treat physical health. In other words, if you look at a diabetic, diabetes is incurable, but it's medically manageable. Schizophrenia is incurable, but is also medically manageable. And what we have, in effect, are two separate health delivery systems in this state through our health insurance policies that, in fact, treat these mental health diseases very, very differently. And so as we get into discussions of cost, I don't want to lose the discussion of the philosophy and the discussion of the equity and the fairness that comes. Why should an individual who suffers from schizophrenia receive any less
coverage, whatever it is, whatever the policy calls for, if we receive any less coverage than for the physical disease. We've heard the word mandate, and we've all been, who have been throughout this process for many years, dealt with that issue in terms of healthcare mandates in one fashion or another. Healthcare mandates typically come to the legislative body because, for one reason or another, the insurance community chooses not to provide that coverage or those services by a particular provider. But in this particular case, we're not talking about a new mandate. We have a mental health mandate. We have an alcohol and drugs mandate. We have specific provisions in the statute that covers those. Legislative Council and Insurance Commissioner has said that this Senate Bill 529 and what is reflected here in this bill is not a mandate for the purposes of the Oregon statute. So I'm concerned as we continue to hear the same kind of rhetoric of a mandate, and I believe very strongly that this is an issue of philosophy, equity, and fairness. Not to dwell extremely on the issue of cost, but we have provided an actuarial study done by an actuary who has been in 12 to 14 other states providing similar kinds of services, and we've had those discussions privately and in public. But until today, we have not received one comment, one new actuarial study regarding the issue of parity, or the 40% proposal, which has now been reduced to 25%. Not until today did we receive any numbers, nor have we received any response other than we don't agree with the actuarial study at the 3%. And I hope through the study, Mr. Chairman, through this interim process, that we're all going to be forced to the table with numbers and tables and documents so that we truly can get at the actual cost of this benefit. In another particular area, there's surrounding the issue of mental health is always the issue of what I term the black hole. That there are people who believe that if we provide an enhanced mental health benefit, that it's all going to fall down into a black hole and going to eat up our cost. I submit to you, Mr. Chairman, that this also is something that I think the study should look at. To get rid of this myth that physical health is somehow more predictable in terms of cost than mental health. Finally, to the compromise, as you know, Mr. Chairman, it's been elusive. Obviously, the coalition wanted total parity. We have gone from a proposal of total parity, which we brought to you, to one of 40% plus a date certain, to 25% and a study. And I think, as we've discussed, we feel very, very strongly that at some point in this process that we need to get to a date certain. I'm hopeful that in the interim study that we're going to be able to provide the type of information back to you that will justify date certain, not in 5 to 6 years, but full 100% parity. You and Mr. Chairman and Senator Hannon have been very great adversaries on this issue, and I want to commend you for being able to come together on this proposal, and I feel very strongly that it will provide the data that in the end will show to any reasonable person that in fact parity has virtually very low cost, and in over a long period of time, if you factor in reduction in physical health costs, will in fact save health insurers money and hopefully get us away from what I believe is a very discriminatory practice in how we deal with mental health versus physical health. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr.
I'm Carmen Powell. I'm a psychiatrist in private practice, and I'm here speaking on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. This bill does not affect physician political position or physician income. So why would the Oregon Medical Association be allocating a significant percent of its lobbying effort that there's no economic advantage to its membership. Physicians sit across from patients daily, and they sit across from a significant number of patients who have psychiatric problems that are treatable. These patients don't know that they don't have mental health coverage that's adequate for their problems. They hold jobs, they pay their benefits, they have health care coverage, they assume they have a basic benefit that covers usual medical illnesses. That is true, it is not true for the mental health basic medical problems. These patients are in trouble. But we're all vulnerable to illness. One in four of us get some kind of mental problem in our lifetime. Now, this is an anxiety problem or depression. We have that ourselves, or we have a family member with schizophrenia or alcoholism. If it's one in four, it's not.
Mr. Chairman, it's been elusive. Obviously, the coalition wanted total parity. We have gone from a proposal of total parity, which we brought to you, to one of 40% plus a date certain, to 25% and a study. And I think we've discussed, we feel very, very strongly that at some point in this process, that we need to get to a date certain. I'm hopeful that in those In the interim study that we're going to be able to provide the type of information back to you that will justify date certain, not in 5 to 6 years, but full 100% parity. You and Mr. Chairman and Senator Hannon have been very great adversaries on this issue, and I want to commend you for being able to come together on this proposal, and I feel very strongly that it will provide the data that in the end will show to any reasonable person that in fact parity has virtually very low cost, and in over a long period of time, as you factor in reduction in physical health costs, will in fact save health insurers money and hopefully get us away from what I believe is a very discriminatory practice in how we deal with mental health versus physical health. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. I'm Connie Powell. I'm a psychiatrist in private practice, and I'm here speaking on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. This bill does not affect physician political positions or physician income. So why would the Oregon Medical Association be allocating a significant percent of its lobbying effort if there's no economic advantage to its membership? Physicians sit across from patients daily, and they sit across from a significant number of patients who have psychiatric problems that are treatable. These patients don't know that they don't have mental health coverage that's adequate for their problems. They hold jobs, they pay their benefits, they have health care coverage. They assume they have a basic benefit that covers usual medical illnesses. That is true. It is not true for the mental health basic medical problems. These patients are in trouble. But we're all vulnerable to illness. 1 in 4 of us get some kind of mental problem in our lifetime. Now, this is an anxiety problem or depression. We have that ourselves, or we have a family member with schizophrenia or alcoholism. If it's 1 in 4, it's lots of us in this room. We all know someone in this situation.
So if you're looking around.
We can look out and we can look in.
One of us up here has a problem.
I really have another point in mind.
Mr. Chairman, just blame me, everyone else.
But that looking, that it's probably someone else, that is kind of our attitude. It's worrisome to think about having a mental problem, and for Americans, it's particularly worrisome to think about a mental illness that has to do with feelings, and Americans are kind of uncomfortable with that. We believe in mind over matter, so people come into my office with a depression, and they feel they've done something wrong, and they feel guilty, and they feel ashamed, and they don't know why this has happened, and they don't know why they can't solve it, and they feel they should be pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. They feel that they're doing something and that they need to be able to solve it. Now, what we know now is that these are genetic diseases. They're biochemically determined. They're biochemically treatable. They're easily treatable. We have effective treatments. Our health care benefit does not reflect this. And because people feel guilty and uncertain that it's all right to even have this disorder, they haven't spoken out, and the insurance industry hasn't felt they need to respond to what they really generally know, what is well known in the medical literature about the incidence of these, how common they are, and how easy they are to treat. It wasn't too many years ago before that people felt guilty when they had cancer, and that was a family secret, and they didn't feel that they could talk about that openly, and they thought maybe they had done something wrong. So we're still a little, we're not quite current with mental illness, but we're getting there. So because we're reluctant to think about it, know about it, and provide a normal benefit for it, people, 1 in 4, get caught. I know of a young woman who has a bipolar disorder, and she had her episode when she was a freshman in college. and she got psychotic, and she had private insurance, and it was adequate to treat part of her disorder. So she exhausted her benefits, she needed more treatment, she couldn't think straight, she couldn't go back to school, and she couldn't get a job. She went on to public assistance, she went on to the Oregon Health Plan, which does not discriminate against mental illness, and this is a critical junction in her life. Things would go very differently whether she got treatment or didn't get treatment. She did get treatment. She's now back in school, and she's earning A's. So this is a success story of sorts. This patient survived her illness, and she survived her private health care policy. But not all stories go so well. I think there's a question about whether private carriers should be allowed to shift the cost of insurance to the public sector and allow the Oregon taxpayers to pick up the cost for any patient who is treatable that exceeds their benefit in the Oregon plan. In focus groups of Oregon Medical Association physicians, the physicians talked a lot about the shift of care from the private sector to the public sector because there is no catastrophic insurance in the private sector in Oregon. And they talked about patients with mental disorders who lose their jobs, who could have maintained a normal life if they had access to treatment. One of my patients with manic depression, she works as a software engineer, and she has three children who are teenagers, and because of her vulnerability to illness, she has greater need for treatment right now than her insurance will allow her, that she can really pay for. So I subsidize her. But she can, with a little extra help, keep her job and manage three teenagers, which we all know is no mean feat anyway. But she, without adequate treatment, she would default to the public sector. This wouldn't be too good for her. It wouldn't be good for the children. I don't really see it being a help to the Oregon taxpayer. This is an important question about whether we should permit private carriers to not provide a basic package of care for a significant section of the population. If the carriers need some sort of public subsidy, perhaps we can study that and provide a different mechanism rather than just doing the inadequate benefit thing. Thank you.
So Mark, I'm probably going to regret it just writing down this stuff, but can I get a copy of your actuarial study, please?
Chair, Senator Dukes, I have it right here, and I'll be glad to give you all the numbers and the total study.
It occurred to me that if yours came with an actuary attachment, put the two of them into a room, and they would give you something. Never mind.
Be happy to provide it.
We tried that.
Okay. Okay, any other questions? I just wanted to ask the doctor, you observed us long enough to tell which one of us up here is.
I think that would be confidential.
Good answer.
Okay. All right.
The chairman, there are eight of us, and I think she just pointed to both sides.
Okay, thank you very much for your special
information. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, Dave, that means... Bill Dalton is here? Okay. So we've got 20 minutes left, and we have quite a list here of people that want to talk. So we have Doris Maynard, Richard Boyle, and Peter Essner. They want to come forward. Appreciate you taking the time today to come back.
You want to leave them?
Sure, I can.
Whatever you wish. Just identify who you are, if you would, please, then.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Peter Asma, and I'm clinical director at Serenity Lane Treatment Center in Eugene.
Yeah, I can't quite hear you.
I'm clinical director at Serenity Lane in Eugene.
Okay.
First of all, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon and to share a few thoughts with you about this bill. And before I begin, I would like to ask you to take just one moment, and if you would please picture in your mind what it is we're talking about here in terms of the people that are impacted by this bill, specifically those that are chemically dependent. And what is it that an alcoholic addict looks like? And is there a stigma to this disease? And as you picture that chemically dependent person or that addict, I would like you to take a look at me, because I'm an addict in recovery. And I've been in recovery for 15 years. And it is through the gift of treatment that I was able to come out of my addiction and move into a life of recovery. Had I not had that opportunity, I can assure you that I would not be here before you today. And we can talk about actuarials, but behind all those numbers, I would implore that you not forget the faces of the people whose lives are impacted daily and the families that are impacted daily by this deadly disease that was declared a disease by the American Medical Association in the late 1950s and is still, unfortunately, in my opinion, stigmatized in this country today. I do not necessarily believe that we would be before you here today asking for a 25% increase and advocating for this bill if we were, in fact, treated like all other medical diseases. But, in fact, that is the case, and I would implore that you consider passage of this bill as the beginning step and a wonderful step in moving towards recognition of the rights and the needs for people who are chemically dependent or mentally ill and moving forward with the adequate coverage. The coverage benefit has not changed since 1987. What other industry do you know that is asked to operate and deliver care and services on standards and dollars that are 12 years old without any increases? So I look forward to and applaud the work that you have done at this point to get this bill to its current state and ask that we continue the process of review and acknowledging the need for equitable treatment for those that are chemically dependent. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hello, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Dick Boyle, a retired psychiatric social worker from Oregon State Hospital, having served there for 20 years. And a mental health advocate, as well as a member of the Capital City Task Force for AARP, as well as the Mental Health Association of Marion County, and involved in the coalition as well. My main concern in this situation is that we try not to focus on cost exclusively, but on the benefits that will serve, as well as the people who are not served effectively, who are a cost as well. And that seems to be a factor that's not, if you just preoccupy yourself with cost and not see what benefits you derive, and the people that will be benefited from this service, you're losing the basic issues involved. There are 17 or 19 states or thereabout that have some degree of mental health parity, and that indicates to me that it's a issue that is growing in importance throughout the country and should be Oregon should be included as well in this process. As far as all the actuarial studies, I don't pretend to know all that, although I have had some indication of it. We originally were going to go on SB 529, which would be 40%, and we went down to 25% now on this particular bill. And this is a compromise, and certainly one that needed to be done so something would be done. I want something to happen, and I don't. I'm somewhat of a pragmatist. I like to see. I don't have the ideal. I know that things don't happen. Ideally, they go in increments, and this is what I consider an incremental improvement into the mental health situation, which I think is desirable, but not utopian in any sense. Thank you.
Senator Driscoll and other members of the committee, my name is Doris Menard. I am currently the president of the board of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. I'm the mother of a son who has schizophrenia. I'm a former teacher, school guidance counselor, and building principal. Significant effort was devoted to Senate Bill 529, Mental Health Parity and Health Insurance, by the members of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. As we approach the end of the legislative session, we want to thank you for this opportunity to have a public hearing. The raising of the limitations on insurance coverage by 25% and the offer of an interim study committee, and we are grateful for that, is in reality piecemeal parity. It ends 25% of the discrimination against people with brain disorders and an offer to study the problem, but no date certain for the ending of the remainder of the discrimination. As you know, between 1% of the population of Oregon, as around the country, suffer from schizophrenia, another 2-3% with bipolar disorder, and a greater majority with major depression. These are all neurobiological disorders, physical illnesses of the brain. This translates into thousands of Oregonians and their families who will receive little relief in their insurance coverage. Victims of these disorders and their families often must choose between treatments which work and the financial stability of the family itself. While 25% may seem a major adjustment in health insurance benefits, for those who have severe brain disorders, it translates into 2 or 3 additional days in the hospital. The brain continues to suffer discrimination. Are other organs of the body deemed to be more important than the brain? Persons suffering from their disorders more worthy? While we applaud Senator Hannon and others of his colleagues who have really persisted and been diligent in supporting this bill, we who advocate for those who cannot advocate for themselves will continue to pursue what is right, what is common decency, what is possible, what the facts show, what 24 other states have done, what 75% of Oregonians surveyed said they supported, and that is health insurance parity for severe brain disorders. We look forward to the opportunity of the interim study committee and to the prompt resolution of this in the next legislative session. Thank you.
Thank you for coming to this session. I just have one because I want to ask Dr. One of the things that we have heard is that we all have a concern about, and I think Senator Hannon alluded to it, the fact that we are not going to raise the amounts of dollars that are going to be available. Will you raise your rates?
We would be raising our rates only in the standard that any other business operates their rates when the utilities are increased in our cost of operations. We wouldn't be raising the rates in response to any passage of a
particular bill. You'd be raising the rates the same amount whether you've got the 25% or not.
That's the reality in order to stay in business, yes. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you all three for coming in.
Thank you.
We have Ann Heath, Joanne Atchison, and Carl McCabe. We've got about 10 minutes left, so you guys can divide it up the way you like. We have one other person that probably won't get up here. we have a few other nations, but we do have other committees here.
Hi, I'm Ann Heath, and I'm here because I have a son with schizophrenia, and very appreciative to Senator Herron for fighting the battle around this issue. And as I was listening, I was thinking, I appreciate you for your good intentions. But I also thought, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And having a son with mental illness is a hellish experience. And having a mental illness is a hellish experience. My son was perfectly normal. We have no history of mental illness as far as anybody ever knew in our family. And he was a freshman in college. Grew up perfectly healthy, normal, good prospects, and developed schizophrenia in the spring of his freshman year at college, which is age 18 for young men, is often the case with schizophrenia. It's a brain disorder, and his personality changed. He became very withdrawn and frightened. He was hearing voices telling him very pejorative things about himself that he couldn't figure out where they were coming from. He'd get into arguments with me about it when I would try to convince him it was a mental illness because he has no insight. His thinking was very disordered. Fortunately or unfortunately, he never got hospitalized because he never became dangerous in any way. I used to sometimes pray that he would because maybe he would then agree to take a medication or someone would force him to take a medication. And from my point of view, it was, you know, I was in shock for the first couple of years over the whole situation. And, you know, this is my son here. And I, you know, at one point I thought to myself, okay, I can't cure the mental illness. There's no cure for schizophrenia, but no son of mine's riding at the back of the bus. So I can put my energy into trying to fight against the discrimination that's so rampant. And I have to say, I know it makes people nervous to talk about mental illness, and you all started laughing up which one of us has the mental illness, but you can't tell who's going to get a mental illness. It comes in all kinds of families, even families of private employers, small businessmen. Their children get mental illness. They themselves get mental illness. It's fairly common, actually. The good news with my son is after about 5 years of him pretty much living in this hell, really, he did agree to talk to another man who had schizophrenia who was being treated with a new medication called Zyprexa. And he agreed to take it. And after about a month of taking the medication, he went back to school. He went to Chemeketa for a year and a half. And he's now at Portland State. He's doing very well. He doesn't think he has anything wrong with him, and we don't talk about it that much. The medication was very helpful, and I guess one of my big fears is I'm hoping he will become employable. He's expecting to work. I don't want him discriminated against in his health plan when he goes to work. And he's going to probably need lifelong treatment. Schizophrenia, right now, there's no cure. There used to not be any really effective treatment, so there's a lot of hope around mental illness right now, and even around schizophrenia, which was probably, in most people's minds, the worst form of mental illness. So anyway, I just wanted to, I guess, put a face on it and let you know.
Well, I appreciate that. I have a daughter with that, so I'm familiar with her.
Okay. And you know.
I'm Joanne Atchison, Senator Durbin and members of the committee. I, too, have a son with schizophrenia, and he's married, and his wife also has mental illness. The main thing that concerns me again is why is his illness treated differently than if he had some other kind of physical illness? It shouldn't be that way. It's hard enough to live with a mental illness, but being discriminated against is a double whammy. It's a whammy for them and it's a whammy for the parents. Treatment does work. My son's a good bit older than Ann's, and the treatment has improved so much in the last few years that it's worthwhile spending money on it now. We're able to get these young people back on their feet, employable. My son's an honor student in college, hopes to be employable in the future. But again, he will need maintenance. And he will need the drugs that are extremely expensive to keep his illness under control. but without insurance parity, you won't be able to have it. So I'm hoping again that we can get some fairness for people who have been dumped with mental illness. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, Senators, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. My name is Carl McDade. I'm a sergeant with the Portland Police Bureau. I'm also a member of the board of the National Alliance for Mentally Ill here in Oregon. I have a few comments to make from two perspectives. The first one is as a police officer, and the second one is as a 30-year registered Republican. I train police officers from Arizona to Seattle and throughout the state of Oregon in how to deal with the mentally ill in these terrible situations which we get involved with on the street, because there are so many mentally ill people in this country who do not have treatment. I listened to some of the folks from Associated Oregon Industries and talking about they weren't aware that there was a problem. I have my cards here, and any of you folks who wish to come along with a ride along with me any night in North Precinct, there is a very terrible problem, and you will see it, of the lack of treatment for folks with mental illness. My second set of comments, very briefly, is around what I believe are Republican values. We've talked here about cost. There is no increase in cost. The costs are the same. It's who bears the cost. That is the question. As Republicans, we believe that the private sector should take care of as many issues as possible. What we are talking about here is ending discrimination, setting up a level playing field, and allowing the private sector then to take care of what is its responsibility as opposed to the taxpayers. We now have in Multnomah County 25% of our inmates who are mentally ill. Okay? The taxpayers are paying for them. These family members go bankrupt because they can't afford to pay for the medicines that their insurance policies won't pay for, and their children go on the Oregon Health Plan, and the taxpayers pay. What we are talking about here in the big picture is whether or not we want the taxpayers to pay, or whether or not we want to spread the cost of this through insurance, which is the function of the insurance industry in society. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Again, you just have a question.
For the record, my name is Barbara Samaglia. I'm the director of the Office of
Alcohol.
Yes, for the record, Barbara Samaglia. I know. You'll get it one day. Director of the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs in the Department of Human Resources. I won't take a lot of time, and I want the others to have an opportunity. I want to speak in support of Senate Bill 1331, and I just want to make a few points that haven't already been made. You've heard that addiction, alcoholism, drug addiction, is a biologically based disease with psychological and social adjunct behavioral problems. 80% of the people that experience alcoholism and drug addiction are in fact employed. What happens to these people? Many of them, unfortunately, because they can't access the treatment that they need while they're working, end up falling further and further into problems until they lose their employment and they end up in the public sector. And most often, as you just heard, they might end up in the criminal justice system. 80% of the people incarcerated have an alcohol or drug problem. We pay much, much more to house a prisoner for a year than we would pay to treat someone early and intervene in these serious illnesses. Our office did a study several years ago that showed for every dollar we invest in treatment for addiction, we save $5.60 in avoided social costs. We know we have a long way to go to improve our system, and the Oregon strategy has put forth ways to do that, that engage the private and public sector partners to look at how we need to improve our system. Our office stands ready to work with you. We support the idea of the proposed interim committee. I want to remind you that we have a number of partners, public and private, already working on these issues. The Department of Human Resources has convened this past year a task force on dual diagnosis, and we are trying to gather the kind of information that you're also interested in to help us move forward and find long-term solutions to these issues. So I want to support this bill. I want to thank you for this public hearing, and I want to pledge that our office will do whatever it can to work with you as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm Mark Hudson. I'm the president of Springbrook Northwest. We are a regional drug and alcohol treatment program just outside of Portland, Oregon. I'd just like to also...
I won't take a lot of time, and I want the others to have an opportunity. I want to speak in support of Senate Bill 1331, and I just want to make a few points that haven't already been made. You've heard that addiction, alcoholism, drug addiction, is a biologically based disease with psychological and social adjunct behavioral problems. 80% of the people that experience alcoholism and drug addiction are in fact employed. What happens to these people? Many of them, unfortunately, because they can't access the treatment that they need while they're working, end up falling further and further into problems until they lose their employment and they end up in the public sector. And most often, as you just heard, they might end up in the criminal justice system. 80% of the people incarcerated have an alcohol and or drug problem. We pay much, much more to house a prisoner for a year than we would pay to treat someone early and intervene in serious illnesses. Our office did a study several years ago that showed for every dollar we invest in treatment for addiction, we save $5.60 in avoided social costs. We know we have a long way to go to improve our systems, and the Oregon strategy has put forth ways to do that, that engage the private and public sector partners to look at how we need to improve our systems. Our office stands ready to work with you. We support the idea of the proposed interim committee. I want to remind you that we have a number of partners, public and private, already working on these issues. The Department of Human Resources has convened this past year a task force on dual diagnosis, and we are trying to gather the kind of information that you're also interested in to help us move forward and find long-term solutions to these issues. So I want to support this bill. I want to thank you for this public hearing, and I want to pledge that our office will do whatever it can to work with you as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm Mark Newton. I'm the president at Springbrook Northwest. We are a regional drug and alcohol treatment program just outside of Portland, Oregon. I'd just like to also thank the committee for this public hearing. Much of what you heard today, I can only say me too. That
In fact, I would go a step farther and say that the diseases of the brain are probably more important to treat than other diseases of the body, since it is the brain that controls the organs, it controls the heart, the liver, the lungs, that are so adequately and well covered in most insurance programs today in the state. It is also the brain that controls the behavior, and much of what we associate with mentally ill people and those that are addicted reflect on that behavior. So if we can manage and control the diseases of the brain, many of the social costs and many of the problems that we associate with the addicted and the mentally ill can be corrected and corrected quite successfully. The final comment I'd like to make is, although this bill is a compromise, I view it as a step along a very historical and cherished path that this country has taken. Passage of this bill will continue the work begun by early Quakers in this country that when they went into prisons and asylums to help those suffering from addiction and mental illness. Passage of this bill will also begin to answer Dr. Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, who pleaded in 1780, commissioned by George Washington to study this very issue, who pleaded with his colleagues to treat those who were afflicted with mental illness and addiction with all the available compassion and science available today at the time. The way the insurance pays for these illnesses discriminates against those who can't defend themselves. If your brain is sick, you can't defend yourself. So I urge you today to pass this bill and let us get on with the work that needs to be done. Thank you.
I'm watching.
Okay.
See, my name is Anthony Wisniewski. I live in West Salem. I'm a member of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, the Salem Group, known as SAMI. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a lobbyist. I'm not an insurance industry individual. I'm from the trenches. My son is paranoid schizophrenic with a dual diagnosis. I just recently attended the White House conference on the mental ill health issues that was put on by the Vice President's wife, Tipper Gore. We were at Portland. It was very interesting. My son, I have a few goals for him. Currently, right now, one of the first ones is to get insurance for him because he has no insurance. He is currently taken care of by Marion County Mental Health. Prior to him becoming 21, he had good insurance because I'm in the military and we had Champus, and it took care of him. Currently, right now, he falls between the cracks. He can't get the Oregon Health plan because his wife makes too much money. She can't afford insurance for him because he's been refused insurance. And the Oregon legislature has provided an insurance method for him to obtain insurance, but he can't afford that insurance because it costs $150 a month, plus the deductibles with it. The cost to society, I believe, will be reduced, just as Officer from Portland stated, by making mental health, the consumers of mental health benefits, workers, and providing their own cost. The cost of society will be reduced by the cost of possibly people being in jail. My son spent 6 months in jail. It was more expensive to have him in jail than it was to have him taken care of when he was in the mental health hospital. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Again, we really appreciate your taking your time to come down and help us understand the issues. Very much. Thank you very much. We had one other person also finish his screen. Well, Egan, if you can finish it up, otherwise we're not.
Be real brief.
Otherwise, we're not going to pass this bill today.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Arthur Kunis. I'm the
Research and Education Director for the Oregon AFL-CIO. And I, in fact, have a daughter who has fallen through the cracks. She has multiple diagnoses, and she is one of that number. I'm before you today in support of Senate Bill 1331. This bill is far too late for many who have already fallen through the cracks. So the Oregon AFL-CIO welcomes Senate Bill 1331 as an affirmative step in the right direction. As you already know, many, many people from very diverse interests have worked long and hard for mental health parity, and support for this ideal crosses many lines, cultural, political, economic, and others. The reason for this is quite simple. There is scarcely a family in America that is not touched by mental illness. That is why we are here today in support of this bill, which may help many families of working people in Oregon at least a little. I would like to repeat what we see this, that we see this bill as a step in the right direction, and as such, we encourage you to pass it. It is only a step, and we will be pleased to see this legislative body do more work in this area and carry on this debate in the interim so that we may accomplish a more comprehensive legislation in the future. The mind is part of the human body, and as such, should not be treated as inferior. Do what is right and pass this bill. Thank you very much.
My name is Earl Egan. I'm the father of a mentally ill daughter that has schizophrenia. The illness struck her just about the time she earned her degree in elementary education. And this disease has robbed her of her career and her basically life for the last 18 years. Her illness, when she was first struck with this illness, she was hospitalized. And at that time, I had had insurance for her, health plan insurance for her, and the coverage that it provided was soon used up, and she was hospitalized for a couple of weeks at that point in time. The hospital bill was well over $15,000 at that time. And the health insurance plan did not allow that much money to be paid. I went to the hospital and told them that she didn't have any money, and since she was an adult now, I don't think I was responsible for paying for that bill. The hospital wrote that off, and subsequently she's been hospitalized a couple more times in the public sector. So what's happened here is that the insurance companies are dumping these problems onto the public sector. The taxpayers pay for it. And the word discrimination has been used many times here already today, but it's a real problem. And I think that this discrimination that occurs needs to come to an end. The polls show that over 70% of the people are willing to pass this full parity bill. It's been reduced down to 25%, and certainly most of the electors are willing to support this bill. Now, we've been talking about mandates here. I think 70% of the people are mandating the legislature to pass this bill. And why you won't follow that kind of a mandate is beyond me. I'm certainly in favor of supporting this Senate bill. As it stands, there's a 25% increase, but it's a piddling amount. It really is. For those that have to be hospitalized, $2,500, which this represents, really is only a couple of days in the hospital for a person that is really severely mentally ill. And it just isn't right that it should be kept at such a puny amount. I think we should really consider that a full parity bill. As the studies show, we should be able to afford it. For the price of a cup of coffee, as the studies show, you can have full parity. Certainly, you can certainly have this 25% increase easily without incurring very much cost. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1331. And the chair would entertain a motion for an open vote. And the chair would entertain a motion to pass the...
Should we move the dash two amendment? I will move the dash two amendment, SB1331.
Thank you. Senator Weil moves the dash two amendment. Any objections? Hearing none?
Should I move it? I will move SB1331 as amendment to the floor to pass recommendation.
Senator Weil moves Senate Bill 1331 to the floor to pass recommendation as amended, right?
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay. You going to make a statement?
No.
A short one.
Okay, short.
Very short.
Short one. I just want to say thank you for everybody that came, and that sometimes you think that we're untouched by all these things. In the last 9 days, two senators' children have tried to commit suicide, overdosed, and hospitalized. And one senator said something of their family. There's another senator and I sat on the floor about all the turmoil going on in our own family with children and kids. We're not untouched. And I really relate with everybody that spoke today. And I wanted to thank you for coming.
Can you call that a short speech?
I'm short. I should have been longer.
No, I'm not sure.
For
Take care of your voice.
Senator Weil?
Aye.
Senator Starr? Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Dukes?
Aye.
Chair Burford?
Aye. I think we'll let Mr. Shannon say it again.
Aye.
Aye.